From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new musical comedy series Glee, about a high school glee club of misfits and losers, will have a preview episode on Fox tomorrow night after American Idol. On today's Fresh Air, the creator of Glee, Ryan Murphy. He also created the teen comedy series Popular and the very adult series Nip Tuck about two plastic surgeons. We'll hear about his shows and his experiences that led to them. Also, before the familiar sounds of the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane, a record company called Trident Productions was trying to make its mark on the San Francisco rock scene. Rock historian Ed Ward tells the story of a label that never quite hit the big time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new Fox musical comedy series Glee, about a high school glee club, will have a special preview episode tomorrow night, right after American Idol's final night of competition. But the series won't begin until the fall. My guest Ryan Murphy is the creator of Glee. He also co-created the WB teen comedy series Popular and the FX series Nip Tuck, about two cosmetic surgeons. Murphy directed the film adaptation of the Augustine Burroughs book, Running with Scissors. Glee is about a high school teacher trying to put together a winning glee club with a group of students who are largely unpopular misfits and, with a couple of exceptions, don't appear to be particularly talented. Reviewing Glee in Entertainment Weekly, Ken Tucker called the show terrific. Here's a scene of some students auditioning for the glee club.
My name is Mercedes Jones, and I'm singing R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Take care of TCP. Oh, hey, baby.
Hello, I'm Kurt Hummel. I'll be singing Mr. Cellophane.
Cellophane, Mr. Cellophane, should have been my name, Mr. Cellophane, 'cause you can look right through me, walk right by me, and never know I'm there, never even knew. See, I kissed a girl. It's not what I'm used to, just wanna try you on. I'm curious for you, caught my attention. I kissed a girl, I liked it.
Ryan Murphy, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, the premise of the show is that there's a teacher trying to put together a really good show choir who can make it to the Nationals and even win, even though he's working with this kind of like ragtag group. I'm not familiar with a show choir, and I assume that these exist, that you didn't just make it up for the series. But the show choir, it's like a choir, and it's a singing competition, but what they compete with is big like song and dance production numbers. It's not just, you know, people in robes standing there singing.
No, I mean, it was an interesting thing that I had when I was a kid. I was in choir, but it was, you know, literally 16 of us in sad looking tuxedos and acetate dresses,
right.
singing, you know, Christmas songs. But the world has changed since then. And when we started writing this, we would go onto YouTube and we would look at these videos of these extravaganzas, and they are literally like Broadway level shows. I mean, we were working with a choir during the pilot from Burbank who I think literally would spend $100,000 a year on costumes and sets and production value. So they had, I think, one woman who was a full-time sequin sewer. So we sort of tap into that a little bit. But on our show, you know, our show was about underdogs, but we have the world's worst glee club. And I think the fun of the show to me is being able to sort of chart these kids who have nothing going for them but heart and, you know, natural talent. And then over the course of the series, they will hopefully become national champions.
So while you were going onto YouTube to look at all these show choir production numbers, what were some of the most unlikely songs that you saw show choirs do?
I think it was very interesting about how moving it was to me. I was not expected to be so moved by it, but I think there's nothing more moving than kids singing and performing their hearts out, just because it seems like they're tapping into something so pure.
That's what I'll even go to like high school production number, high school musical sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, it's sweet. And, you know, I remember being that age, and when you do perform and you are in high school, it doesn't, I mean, I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana, but I thought that I was on Broadway. You know, you have this sort of weird misconception that the whole world is open to you, and maybe that's not a misconception, maybe it's the truth, but I pulled from that. That feeling is in the show. But to answer your question, the funniest thing I saw was a boy band tribute where they did like a medley of 15 boy band songs that, I thought was pretty amazing, but they did it through the prism of Western wear, where they all wore cowboy outfits. And it was sort of this weird smash-up of elements that you kind of can't believe would work, but it did. And it worked because it was just so earnest. They believed in it so much. And that's what I loved about it.
So how did you go about, like, shopping for songs that you should use? And what were some of the more unlikely ones you decided on? I'll name one. I kissed a girl for the audition.
Right. The best part of my job is I pick all the songs. And people ask me how I do it. And it's just bizarre. I don't really know. Like, for instance, when we were doing the pilot, there was the sort of arch nemesis group, the world's best show choir that's competing against our little ragtag group of losers called Vocal Adrenaline. And they're sort of like, you know, the neo-Nazis of show choir that they train for 12 hours a day. And there really are groups like this, so it's not too much of a leap of faith. But I wanted them to do something that was sort of big and ironic. And then I was in my car and I was listening to the Amy Winehouse album Back to Black, and Rehab came on, and I thought, well, that's it, because I think it'd be funny for 16-year-olds to be singing about rehab and not really knowing what they're singing about, put through a prism of show choir. So that's how we did that. There are other songs that, you know, I just loved as a kid. Like, you know, we're working on a show where we do a big finale to the Queen song Somebody to Love. We're doing our version of Don't Stop Believin' by Journey. Also, the show was fun in that, you know, we try and pick songs where there's something for everybody. We have in almost every episode, we'll have a standard, we'll have a Broadway, we'll have a R&B, we'll have a top 40, we'll have a hip hop, we're doing country and western, so we're trying to hit everything.
Now, one of the kids in the choir is like the real nerdy guy who plays a real like shredding guitar, but he's he's in a wheelchair. So
yes,
how do you cast like the nerdy guy in the wheelchair? What were you looking for that character? And
I was just, for every character, you know, I mean, I think when you do a show like this, you need to do archetypes, but you also need to do things that are just original. And I wanted to do a character that from day one is in a wheelchair and remains in a wheelchair for the rest of the show. And the show is really about, you know, the show choir thing, I think, is a metaphor for being different and embracing your different and being your difference and being able to express yourself no matter how hard or how much pain you're in. So for instance, for that character, we just read and read and read, and the actor we cast, his name is Kevin McHale, he actually was in a boy band and is in a boy band. And I think the name of their boy band is not, I think it's called Not Like Us. But he's hilarious, and we actually had to give him what we call a make under, because, you know, in his boy band stuff, he's in his tight little t-shirts and come hither looks, and we sort of put him in these polyester horror show outfits. But that's how we cast that part. We just read and read. And, you know, the rule was the best performer wins for every role, and that's how we cast it.
Now, in the TV series Glee, there's a jock who, it turns out, sings really well, and he's kind of enlisted into the Glee Club. And he's accused by one of his fellow jocks of joining the homo explosion. Were you accused of being gay when you were in choir? And you are gay, so...
Yeah.
I
had a very strange experience with that. I mean, I'm from Indiana, and which is a very conservative state. And I don't know what happened to me or by what grace of God I sort of was imbued with all this confidence, but I dealt with my sexuality at a very early age. I was 15, and I just sort of announced it, and I was that. And I guess because I was popular and I hung out with popular kids, you know, one of my best friends, and who is still one of my best friends, was the quarterback. I kind of was embraced. People didn't really understand me, but I projected a certain confidence, so they left me alone. I mean, certainly I got teased a little bit, but I had a very sort of wicked tongue, and I could go right back at them. So it didn't last very long. But looking back on it, I you know, I'm sort of moved by the fact that I didn't have a struggle. And I know so many people who did have a struggle and were terrified of dealing with it. And I dealt with it with my parents very early on, and they, of course, were not happy about it, and they, of course, took me to therapy. But I had a great therapist who, after two sessions, basically called my parents in and said, This is who your son is, and this is who he's always going to be, and you either have a choice to love him or accept him, or he will leave you, and it's your choice. And they sort of said, okay, and they chose accepting me, and so we never really had much drama about it again.
No, you were so lucky, especially since they were the parents who wanted you to change were the ones who put you into therapy. And to find a therapist who got it is kind of so lucky and amazing.
Yeah, you know, and I don't blame my parents about that at all. I mean, also, I was 15 and having an affair with a 22-year-old, which was not good.
Right.
When I have a child, and I would not allow that to happen either. So I sort of look back. Yeah, but I certainly I write about all that. And, you know, as we move to series, we have, a very moving storyline about a father who is coming to terms with the fact that his child is singing and is different, and he's a blue-collar guy. And a friend of mine who's a great actor named Mike O'Malley plays the father of the gay character who works at a tire shop and just cannot believe the fact that his son is dealing with skincare and astringents and singing. And that is, to a certain degree, based on my life. A little bit, but you know, the show is, that's 1/10 of the show. The show, I think, is so much more consuming about every aspect of being young, not just that.
My guest is Ryan Murphy, the creator of the new Fox series Glee. Here's the version of Rehab that's performed in Glee by a champion show choir. We'll talk more with the creator of Glee, Ryan Murphy, and hear about creating his series Nip Tuck after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ryan Murphy, the creator of the new Fox musical comedy series Glee, about a high school glee club. A preview episode will be shown tomorrow night after American Idol. Now, in Glee, all the kids in it are in some ways losers. Like, everyone in it is in some way a loser. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sounds like when you were in high school, you were pretty popular and confident. So why do you relate to losers so much?
Well, because I was different, you know, and my friends were different. I had two groups of people. I had a group called The Clique. There were 8 of us. And then I had my other group of friends. And the group that we called The Clique were all the people who were like in drama club or honor society. And we were just different and unusual. And our dreams were bigger than where we were. And we wanted to get out. And that feeling I really understand. And that's the sort of the feeling that's in all those characters, that, you know, that their dreams are so big that their little heads almost can't contain them. That's what's moving to me. And I certainly draw on my experience when we're writing the show in that way.
So Glee is going to have a preview, like an episode shown on Tuesday, May 19th. So it's like the day before the finale of American Idol. And the series doesn't actually start until September.
Yes.
It's genius in a way, isn't it, to start a series about a singing competition right after American Idol. But who came up with the idea?
Well, you know, even when I pitched the show to them, what I said was I'm not interested in having characters sort of walk down a hallway and break into song. I'm not interested in that. I want the performances to be sort of rooted in performance on a stage or in rehearsal, like American Idol, and I don't want original music. I want to interpret songs from kids now and sort of see their versions of it. And that's what American Idol is. It's sort of the great one-hour karaoke show, and we wanted that feeling is what I wanted on my show. So we did the pilot, and when we turned it in, we started production in February, and they called me around in March, and they said, look, we have this idea, which is to sort of preview it after the penultimate episode of American Idol this year, and what do you think? And I said, well, I don't know. That seems a little scary to me because, you know, then the show will be off the air for 3 months. It doesn't make sense to me. But what they then said that they were going to do is, you know, they said, look at it as a marketing opportunity. And that's what I'm looking at it as. And I think it's very smart. To me, it's like having a movie trailer before James Cameron's Titanic. It's just like a really great thing to do. It's just about sampling the show right now. Because it's an original show. It's a different tone. I think people have to be sort of educated about what they're watching before they watch it.
Music rights are so expensive. Like, if you want to perform a song in a series, mm-hmm. it can cost a fortune, especially mm-hmm. if it's a popular song. So right. how are you handling the music rights for Glee? Do you have access to the American Idol songbook because Fox already paid for the right?
No, we're not tied into that at all. You know, and the interesting thing about when we were writing the pilot is, okay, well, let's try and get Rehab and let's try and get Don't Stop Believing, and chances are we won't because they don't license those songs very often, B, it's too expensive. And much to my delight and surprise, the artist said, yeah, we love this idea. So what has happened with the show is, you know, I just sort of write what I want to write, and then we go after these big artists, and if they say no, which they have, we've shown them the pilot, and they can see that their songs can be reinterpreted by kids for a different audience, and then 9 times out of 10, they've all said, okay, we love this idea, let's do it.
My guest is Ryan Murphy, the creator of the new musical comedy series Glee. The preview episode will be shown tomorrow night on Fox after American Idol. Murphy also created the FX series Nip Tuck about two successful plastic surgeons. Here's a scene from this season's opening episode featuring the two surgeons, Dr. Sean McNamara, played by Dylan Walsh, and Dr. Christian Troy, played by Julian McMahon. The prospective patient is the anesthesiologist from their practice, Dr. Liz Cruz, played by Roma Mafia.
Tell me what you don't like about yourself.
My back. It's an agony from supporting my front.
A breast reduction? Oh, I don't know, Liz.
Those are your two best assets.
They're like having a pair of Louis Vuitton bags. They're great to look at, but they're not a lot of fun to lug around. Look, I have wanted this for a long time, and I figured what better time than now? My boobs will be the first thing you get to put your hands on.
That's very sweet of you, Liz.
Don't you worry, buddy. You won't be scaling those mountains alone. That's a two-man job if ever I've seen one.
Well, you seem like a perfectly good candidate. I'd recommend a post-reduction.
All right, fantastic. Why don't we say tomorrow? The sooner she gets her boobs reduced, the sooner we can give her belly button some room to breathe.
That episode of Nip Tuck began with an opening line that all the episodes begin with. What don't you like about yourself? A question I suspect viewers ask and answer about themselves. Ryan Murphy told me how he came up with that line and with the idea for the series.
I was a journalist before I was a writer and a director, and I went undercover to do an article about plastic surgery in Beverly Hills, and I was going to write this sort of hilarious, snarky article about calf implants for men, which had just come out, which I thought was absolutely insane and ridiculous. And basically what that is they look like plastic shoehorns that you shove up under the muscle in your calf, and it gives you definition. So it's a great way to look like you go to the gym every day when you don't. But I went into this plastic surgeon's office, and I'm not allowed to mention his name, and I pretended I was just there to get calf implants, and he used that line on me, tell me what you don't like about yourself, which started me into a spasm of, well, and I was young at the time. I think I was like 28. But he, by the end of the hour-long consult, he had me convinced about a lot of things, and he actually said to me in the meeting, you know, beauty is symmetry, and I've used that on the show so many times.
Yes.
So the line came, I left that meeting, that consult with the plastic surgeon, and A, I didn't write the article, and B, it sort of threw me because he really made me feel that I would have a happier, better life if I would just sort of work on what he deemed my physical imperfections. But that line came from him, and I've used it every episode, and it does what you says it does, is it's the audience, I think, can really relate to it. Because everybody has stood in front of a mirror and looked at their face and thought, well, what if I do that, or what if I fix that? And that moment came from that guy.
Ryan Murphy will be back in the second half of the show. He's the creator of the FX series Nip Tuck and the new Fox musical comedy series Glee, which will have a preview episode tomorrow night right after American Idol. The series premieres in the fall. Here's the Glee Club singing Journey's Don't Stop Believin'. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Just a small town girl, living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere.
Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, sponsor of the Progressive Automotive X Prize, a race to develop cars that exceed 100 miles per gallon. Now, that's progressive. From Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And from audible.com. You can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, music that's left out of the story of the rise of the San Francisco rock scene in the 60s. Rock historian Ed Ward tells the story of Trident Records. Also, Ryan Murphy, the creator of Glee and Nip Tuck, talks about growing up Catholic and gay. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ryan Murphy, the creator of the new Fox musical comedy series Glee, about a high school glee club. A preview episode will be shown tomorrow night after American Idol. Murphy also created the FX series Nip Tuck, about two successful plastic surgeons. Each episode of Nip Tuck starts with one of the doctors asking a prospective patient, "What don't you like about yourself?" When we left off, Murphy told us he first heard that line when he was a journalist reporting on plastic surgery. Can I ask what you said about yourself when the surgeon said, "What don't you like about yourself?"
I was stunned and I didn't say anything. And he took out this really bizarre measuring thing and had me convinced that when my right ear was like a millimeter higher than my left, and that like that was throwing off my face, and that life was all about first impressions. And even though I didn't know it, if I got my ear fixed, then people would look at me differently. It was just really this convoluted, crazy thing. But he put me in touch. He wanted me to write the article because he thought it would be good publicity, and he put me in touch with a couple of his patients, and then I spoke to them, and they were all just these amazingly, I felt, sad people who were working on the wrong things. And that's what I felt at the end of that session, that I was like, maybe I should go to a shrink instead of a plastic surgeon.
Did you?
But I did. But, you know, the funny thing about Nip Tuck is, to me, is it's always been a show that's completely against plastic surgery. It is a show that basically says, to the culture, you're working on the wrong things. And I'm always amazed that somehow people think that the show is pro-plastic surgery. And indeed, I've gotten letters and calls from people who've had procedures that they've seen on the show because they think that it would make them look better. So apparently I didn't do my job. But
well, let me tell you why I find that nearly impossible to believe. The procedures that you show, it's so hideous to watch it.
I mean,
like, you're watching like rear ends split open so that implants could be put in, and you're watching lipo, and it's just gruesome to watch. I'm sure every surgery, I'm sure tonsillectomies are probably gruesome to watch, and appendectomies, which you need done, and open heart surgery, which you need done. But nevertheless, it's gruesome, and to sit and watch this and think, how can I get one of those?
I agree with you. And when I pitched the show, I was very adamant about that. I wanted to show the violence of the surgeries because I said, unless you do, it's like doing a cop show where none of the cops ever fire the guns. It makes no sense. And that's the thing I've battled, you know, with broadcast standards and practices the most, about how far can you be realistic with what you're showing, you know. But to FX's credit, they've always let me do that, and, you know, with the rare exception, I haven't had to change any of the surgery's content, because I think that they realize that, you know, that that's what the show is about, and we have to show what happens in these surgeries. But you're right, they're horrific and violent and scary, and to the point that, you know, we devise the show for the audience. You know, a surgery is coming. We have a Bang & Olufsen CD player. When they open up that CD player to put that CD in, because we always score those surgeries to pop music, a lot of people say to me, I know that's where I have to either fast forward through, or I'll turn away, or I'll go into the kitchen and get something to eat, because the surgeries are pretty in your face.
Yeah. Well, you know, you told us how you came up with the idea of plastic surgery as the center of a series. But, you know, Nip Tuck also is part crime show, part family drama. How did you come up with the idea of putting all that together into one package?
Well, the thing with Nip Tuck, I always feel that Nip Tuck has been, you know, very misunderstood. To me, the show was really sort of a look at the culture that we were living in then, that is now, I think, kind of ending, which I think it's fitting that the show is ending after 100 episodes. You know, I created that show at the height of in the beginning, I felt, of the luxury consumer industry, where I felt that everything in our culture was incredibly baroque and overdone and oversaturated. So I wanted to do a show that was just about too much excess, too much everything, too many choices available to you, too much placating. And my jumping off point for the show actually was Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I thought that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do a show about the creation of this monster in our culture. Hopefully people have gotten the idea that we really are satirizing the culture, and that's why the show has always had so much in it. So much crime, so much sex, so much surgery, so much money, so much glamour, so much skin. It was always about excess.
Now, you live in the L.A. area, where a lot of people have had cosmetic surgery, in part because there's a lot of wealthy communities there, in part because a lot of actors live there who are almost like required nowadays to get plastic surgery in order to get parts, sadly. Can you always tell? Do you feel like...
I can always tell. I'm really good at that.
What do you look for?
I don't know. It's sort of like my friends have a joke with me that I can spot, you know, I can spot any amount of plastic surgery at 10 paces, and I think it's just because I've watched so many operations and I'm so familiar with the surgeries now after doing this show for 6 years. The thing that's interesting about plastic surgery in Hollywood, I feel, is that it's sort of on the wane. I think they're, you know, I remember when we first started to do casting for Nip Tuck, I would say 95% of the women who came through that door had breast implants. They just did. It was sort of like, you know, it was the trend at the time. And also the big overinflated, horrible lips. But with every passing year, you see less and less and less of that. And in fact, many of these actresses have had those implants and lips taken out or underemphasized because it costs them roles. They don't look real. They can play sort of a hot chick with a window of 4 years and then, you know, it doesn't work anymore. And I think the culture has turned against that look. I think that, you know, it used to be a sign as we, you know, as we're writing the last episode, as we're trying to sum up, well, what was this era about? And I think, you know, plastic surgery in its day was sort of seen as luxury item and a status symbol, but now it's so affordable and it's so cheap and anybody can get it. You can get it at a strip mall that it's no longer, I think, like wearing, the new Chanel sweater or carrying the new Dior bag. It's sort of, it's taken on a different tacky vibe, I think. And I think that, you know, now plastic surgery is not so much about the surgeries and the barbarism of the facelifts. It's about injectables and less radical ways to preserve youth.
Well, you had your fun with Botox on Nip Tuck too.
I did. I had a lot of fun with Botox over the years. Different, new and unusual ways to kill people with Botox, and we sort of did it all.
My guest is Ryan Murphy, the creator of the FX series Nip Tuck and the new Fox musical comedy series Glee. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ryan Murphy. He created the FX series Nip Tuck and the new Fox musical comedy series Glee. Now, you covered Hollywood for the Miami Herald,
right? A lot of places. Washington Post, Miami Herald, Daily News.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you covered Hollywood before actually becoming a part of it in the sense of like creating television shows. When you were just like covering it and you were writing about, you know, new shows and you know, the lives of famous actors and stuff, did you think, I really want to be a part of that? Or did you think, oh, I could do that, or I could do better than that? Like, what was your relationship to Hollywood as a journalist, and did you want to get deeper into it?
I did. I mean, I always wanted to do that. I couldn't really afford to go to film school, even though I was accepted. But I always, in the back of my mind, thought, well, I'll get out there somehow. I don't know how. And how it happened was I was transferred to L.A. at a very young age. I was sort of like the L.A. bureau chief of the Miami Herald back when newspapers had money and could afford to do things like that. And I was going to start writing about news, but there's not a lot of news in L.A., so it became about celebrities and the business of Hollywood and all that stuff, and I had a syndicated column, and it never was that I wanted to be a part of it. I just at one point, I think what happened was I had interviewed Cher for the fifth time, and I was like, okay, you got to do something else. Even though I love her, I can't keep writing about her. We had a joke about it, and I went and I wrote a script, and at night when I was done working, I would stay up every night till like 3 a.m. writing, and I sold that script to Steven Spielberg, and that started my career. It just sort of happened. It was very sort of miraculous, and easy is the wrong word, because I guess that I had been preparing for that moment all along, but I literally just sort of wrote it, sold it, and fell into it, and have never stopped working since. It was a great script that's never been made, but it's called Why Can't I Be Audrey Hepburn? That it was a big romantic comedy, and Spielberg particularly took a shine to it because he directed Audrey Hepburn in her last movie, which was Always. So he had a great relationship with her, and it was just about what she means as a metaphor in terms of romantic comedy to so many people. And it's sort of this paragon of style that so many girls of a particular age always aim to emulate.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ryan Murphy. He's the creator of the FX series Nip Tuck and the new Fox series Glee, which is about a high school glee club or show choir. And that new series has a preview right after the next to the last episode of American Idol on Tuesday, May 19th. So your parents were religious, they were church people. Did that make it harder for them when you came out?
Probably. Yeah, I think, we were Catholic, and that was the things you don't want to do when you're in a Catholic person is talk about abortion or gay rights. So, yeah, I think it probably was more difficult for them. And I went to Catholic school as well.
Oh, so how did you deal with Catholic school and with going to church? I mean, you had been in the church choir. Once you were out, like, could you stay in Catholic school?
I only went to Catholic school when I was in, first through eighth grade. But I was just a weird kid. I mean, I lived in a weird fantasy land, and I was obsessed with, movies and TV shows and books and anything to sort of get me out of there. And I got through Catholic school because I became obsessed with the idea that I could be the Pope. I was very...
You gotta be kidding.
I wanted to be the Pope. It was like, well... So in first grade, I announced to my family that I really wanted to be the Pope, and I was very confused about how do you be the Pope, and so my mother would tell me that you became the Pope by not committing any sins. So I would sort of begin my day every morning with a prayer, please don't let me sin. And of course, by the time I got off the bus, I would have committed three. And then I was like, well, this day's ruined. I'll start again tomorrow. But I would practice with my staff, and I had this outfit of robes. I would pretend to, I was really into it for very, very many years. And then slowly it dawned on me that I would not be able to go through a day committing no sin. And chances were that I wasn't going to be the Pope, so I had to come up with another dream because I wasn't interested in just being a priest. I wanted to aim really, really high.
What?
But that was my childhood.
Outside of being like the top guy, why did you want to be Pope?
I was also obsessed with a book about the saints, and I thought it would be really cool to be the Pope because then you could decide who would get to be saints. And I was very interested in that process of sort of sitting people down or investigating them and figuring out what they had done made them worthy of that. I don't know. I was just very drawn to it. I think it's the same. There's no difference to me in my head about the little 6-year-old kid who was obsessed with the funny girl and who wanted to be the Pope. It's the same thing. You just wanted a way out. You wanted a way to express yourself and to sort of not stay in Indiana and be an insurance salesman or a farmer. And they both were so grand and bigger than life. I was just drawn to that. And I was actually encouraged by my friends and family to keep doing it. So I did. I was just a weird little kid. I liked weird little things.
So since you had at one point wanted to be Pope when you came out and you were kind of persona
non grata. Doesn't that sound ridiculous?
Well,
say you wanted to be the Pope, but I did.
Yeah,
it's
whatever,
sad, I did.
You know. But so when you came out and making you kind of officially persona non grata in the Catholic Church, did it hurt to be rejected by the Church, or were you already done with the Church by then?
I was already kind of done with the Church at an early age, but I'm very, very glad that I had that religious upbringing because, it really taught me about storytelling and it really taught me about theatricality. I mean, the Easter services and the idea of people being raised from the dead and curing leprosy and the, Stations of the Cross and all that stuff I was very drawn to, and I realize now that I was probably drawn to it because it was just about a way to tell a story. And so I feel like I was very well served by that. And I still go to church, even though the church is not very embracing. As a whole, I think if you look at individual archdioceses, you see that, many of the priests and the nuns and the people who work at the church are. So I do go to church. I go to church, here in Los Angeles, and I've always been embraced in the church. The different kind of churches that I go to seem to have a sort of large gay contingency and no one says anything. So I just think that it's a different world than it was. I don't think anything is black or white anymore.
Now, as the creator of Glee, which is a musical and a music competition about music competitions. I have to ask you, if you could get up on stage now and sing any one song, what would you choose?
That's a good one. It would probably have to be Don't Rain on My Parade, because I remember that was the first movie I ever saw, and Funny Girl, and I practiced that one a lot with a kitchen spoon in front of the mirror, so I would probably give that one a try.
Well, I wish I could see it. Ryan Murphy, thanks so much for talking with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Ryan Murphy created the new musical comedy series Glee. Fox will show a preview episode tomorrow night after American Idol.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly, I simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade? I'll march my band out, I'll beat my drum. And if I'm found out, your turn at bat, sir. At least I didn't fake it, hat, sir. I guess I didn't make it, but whether I'm the rose of sheer perfection or freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of its eye, I gotta fly once, I gotta try once, only can die.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on music that came out of San Francisco in the 60s, music the city is not famous for. This is Fresh Air. The rise of the San Francisco rock scene in the mid-1960s is a well-known story, but one which might have taken an entirely different direction. Before the Jefferson Airplane and Grateful Dead rose to stardom, Frank Werber of Trident Productions was trying to get his own stable of artists together. Ed Ward looks at what might have been.
What's going on? What makes me think that I see where I've been wrong? How come I feel that I've been down too long? Won't someone tell me, please, what's going on? Why am I saying things inside my head?
Frank Werber was in a great place in 1964. A Holocaust survivor who'd worked his way up the show business ladder, he'd gotten $1 million when the Kingston Trio, the act he'd groomed and developed since they were frat boys at Menlo College south of San Francisco, signed to Decca Records. He invested in real estate, including a turn-of-the-century skyscraper, 8 stories was skyscraping when it was built, called the Columbus Towers, and installed San Francisco's best recording studio in its basement. Next, he needed talent, and John Stewart of the Kingston Trio told him about a group called the Ridge Runners in Los Angeles that his brother Michael was playing in. Stewart took them into a studio as the Michael Stewart Quintet and sent Werber the tapes. He heard the next logical step past the Kingston Trio. Folk harmonies with a light electric overlay. Werber moved the band north, rehearsed them in his house, and took them into Columbus Recorders as fast as he could because he'd heard a hit.
When I woke up this morning, you were on my mind, and you were on my mind.
I got troubles, oh, I got worries, oh, I got wounds to bind. So I went to the corner just to ease my pain.
With the astounding voice of Bev Bivens up front, the band, rechristened We Five, was soon signed to A&M Records in Los Angeles, which so far had mostly put out stuff by its co-founder, Herb Alpert. It shot into the top 10 in the summer of 1965 and vied with the Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man for the title of the first folk rock record. Werber was probably happy to know that he still had ears for a hit, and soon he was signing and recording more bands. In 1966, Werber signed a deal with Verve, which up to then had mostly been a jazz label, and several interesting records resulted. Perhaps the most famous is the lost masterpiece by Blackburn and Snow, Stranger in a Strange Land.
I am a stranger in a strange land.
This record had come out in early 1966 when it was recorded, and when interest in Robert Heinlein's book was peaking among proto-hippies, it might well have been a hit. But as a sort of a symptom of the problem which would soon destroy Trident, Werber sat on the record for a full year, killing its chances and Blackbird and Snow's career. The other band which might well have made it out of the Trident fold was the Justice League. They recorded numerous times, but nothing was ever released.
There's a hill I couldn't climb when I was young. I was sheltered by my dreams, now shattered mirrors in the sun. But I'm asking you, please don't go away and say the things I could never say. And love me not tomorrow, love me as a child of sorrow. Love me not tomorrow, but today. There are roads.
The lyrics aren't so hot. With better production, Love Me Not Tomorrow would have fit in with what was happening on the radio in 1966. The band changed its name to West, put out two albums which went nowhere, and disbanded. But two Trident acts were eventually to make waves on the greater San Francisco scene. The Sons of Champlin were famous for their energetic shows and Bill Champlin's great voice.
Mr. Guitar, I want so much to have a good time. To try to forget that that girl will never be mine, never be mine. Sing me a breeze, sing me a sky, sing me a rainbow, a dancing of love.
And then there was the mystery trend, whose name came from leader Ron Nagel's mishearing a Dylan lyric. They were older, why Nagel was going bald, and their songs were too literate for top 40 radio.
The boy next door, you know, for years has up and made the headline. With front page red, he lost his head. There's been nothing like this in a long time. No, 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 John, they must be wrong. All his neighbors say Johnny was a good boy, did what he should, but just wouldn't act that way.
But by the time Verve was ready to make something of its deal with Trident in 1967, Werber was losing interest. He'd already passed on the Mamas and Papas and both the Jefferson Airplane and the Charlatans, two of the leading groups in town, because he couldn't deal with their lack of showmanship as he understood it. That same instinct saw him pushing more Broadway material on We Five, whose second album, for reasons that are still not clear, was delayed by a year, sapping the band of momentum. They broke up that May. In 1967, when he could have been one of the most important players in American popular music, Frank Werber folded Trident Productions to concentrate on his real estate, his boat, and his restaurant in Sausalito, also known as the Trident. In 1968, Werber was busted for 268 pounds of pot and went to prison for 6 months. Much of his real estate wound up in the hands of Francis Ford Coppola, whose empire was administered out of the Columbus Towers, and the Trident Restaurant was a fixture for many years on Sausalito's waterfront and had the distinction of being possibly the only restaurant ever robbed by frogmen. Frank Werber died in 2007.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. There's a 2-CD anthology of Trident Productions called Sing Me a Rainbow on the Big Beat label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Reprise and Duck Records, presenting Eric Clapton and Steve Winwood with their new CD and DVD, Live from Madison Square Garden, available May 19th. From Frederica and Howard Stevenson, helping low-income students access education through the Summer Search Foundation at summersearch.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Take these chains from my heart and set me free.
John Doe, the co-founder of the great punk band X, has a new CD of classic country songs. On the next Fresh Air, he performs some of those songs in our studio. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Change from my heart and set me free. Take these tears from